case this morning is Farmer versus Levins. Mr. Palmer?
May it please the court. In over 20 years of doing appellate work, this is the most unusual, unique procedural case I've ever seen. This case originally came to this court as a pro se appeal back in 2001. The case was fully briefed after motions to dismiss the appeal were denied. Afterwards, the court determined that the case would be helped if counsel was appointed for the appellant and did in fact appoint counsel with the direction to file a third amended complaint and then to address in the appeal, based on that third amended complaint, whether this court had jurisdiction and whether the district court had jurisdiction, and also whether the district court improperly dismissed a case with prejudice for improper venue. I was appointed as counsel about a year ago, a little over a year ago, in my position as a professor at Notre Dame for use of this case in moot court. Unfortunately, because
what did the moot court decide?
The moot court decided to take go to a bankruptcy competition in New York City and leave me half this case. No, what the moot court program is simply, I'm appointed counsel by this court and I supervise students in handling these cases, both briefing and oral argument. So normally the students brief the case and do the oral argument. Unfortunately, the complication came in when we were ordered to file the third amended complaint. And because we did not have the documentation and did not have the resources to investigate the allegations that the plaintiffs were making in this case, most of which occurred in the state of Georgia, I moved to withdraw as counsel. The court didn't want me to withdraw as counsel. Instead, the court told me to... And I was generally concerned with Rule 11 problems because I could not do that investigation. So the court instead ordered me to file a supplemental jurisdictional statement, which I did, establishing that this court has subject matter jurisdiction based on diversity. And then once I did that, the court found that it was not necessary to file the third amended complaint and asked me if I desired to, in the court's word, persist in my motion to withdraw, and at which point I accepted the appointment and continued. The original issues, as I said, before the court on appeal was whether this court had subject matter jurisdiction, which I think this court's already determined it had based on the supplemental jurisdiction thing. The remaining issue the court asked me to address is whether a dismissal for improper venue could be a dismissal with prejudice. And I think the case law, very limited case law, because I think this situation does not occur very often, establishes that a dismissal with for improper venue should be without prejudice. Rule 41B states that a dismissal other than a dismissal for improper venue and a couple of other situations, such as failure to join an indispensable party, is not an adjudication on the merits. Therefore, you can refile. But in this case, the district court judge dismissed the case with prejudice, so it could not be refiled, even in a district where venue may be proper. Now, saying that,
if the dismissal was vacated here, case sent back, could it be dismissed as a sanction for some missed court dates and things like that?
It's possible that it could be, but in such a case, the court would either have to do that sua sponte or it'd be the result of a motion, and there would have to be notice to the plaintiffs that that's a possible sanction for missing those court dates. This court, I believe it was in the Bluenstein case, ruled that a pro se plaintiff must be given explicit notice that that sanction is a possibility. And that was not done in this case. There were two possible options for the district court in this case. They could have transferred the case to a venue in Georgia, or it could have dismissed the case without prejudice. But in no case should the court have dismissed it with prejudice and precluded the plaintiffs from refiling elsewhere. There is another issue that I addressed in the brief about the court's refusal to grant the plaintiffs an enlargement of time within which to respond to the several motions to dismiss. And I think that that might be a more appropriate remedy in this case, to remand it to the district court to allow them to address the motions to dismiss, to determine where venue is proper, to determine if any of the other elements of the motions to dismiss are proper, such as failure to join an indispensable party. What happened in this case, the pro se plaintiffs, I don't know if it was because they moved or what the reason was, but they were not served with the motions to dismiss. In fact, motions to dismiss had been granted and later vacated because of improper service. There was another set of motions to dismiss that were granted, at least to Mr. Levinson, and then vacated again later because of improper notice. Ultimately, the district court vacated all dismissals and granted the pro se plaintiffs 2 weeks within which to file a response. Now, first of all, 2 weeks to pro se plaintiffs on very complicated motions raising subject matter jurisdiction, personal jurisdiction, venue, failure to state a claim, failure to join an indispensable party. That's a tall task for even the most accomplished of lawyers, let alone pro se plaintiffs. But in addition, the settlement agreement with the United States, the very basis of this whole litigation, provides that the United States will assist the plaintiffs in the prosecution of any case if that settlement agreement was violated in any way. The farmers, I think justifiably, attempted to get the United States to get involved in this case. They contacted the U.S. Attorney's Office. According to the transcript, they were told that somebody would appear. They were waiting for help. They were waiting for the United States to come in and rescue them on these motions dismissed. The district court acknowledged that, you know, well, maybe if they do come in, that's great, but it's going to take a lot longer than 2 weeks. He didn't say it in those words, but he said it'll take more time than that. Given all those factors, I think that was an abuse of discretion for the district court to deny the motion for enlargement of time and then to turn around and go ahead and dismiss it with prejudice. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Wiegand?
May it please the Honorable Court, Tom Wiegand on behalf of AGI Annuity Insurance Company. Good morning, Your Honor. I wish this were a less common case. Your Honor, what has happened here is that there's a one-year-old child who in 1981 had a surgery that unfortunately injured her. She received a settlement as a minor 4 years later of over $1.6 million. What this case filed before Judge Daigle is the last of a long succession of court proceedings in which, unfortunately, the mother of this minor child was attempting to get those assets for her personal use. There were several proceedings in the state of Georgia, including the state of Georgia taking from the mother the guardianship of that child and assigning it to the public guardian because the funds were being misused.
Is,
in fact,
is any of this in front of us?
That case is not in front of you, but it is described in the complaint that the plaintiff filed, because indeed they admitted that a judgment had been entered against the mother of the child for over $130,000 in Georgia. And so what Judge Daigle was facing was, after that long succession of cases, and then a case in which the mother of this child came to Illinois and obtained a guardianship without telling the court in Illinois that this had already been dealt with in Georgia. that then the then guardian, Ms. Herrera, and my client, who was paying out on an annuity, had to come and inform the court in Illinois, hey, you should know that this has been dealt with in Georgia. The net result of the Illinois proceeding was that the guardianship was extended past the age of 18 to the age of 21, was the result of how the court in Illinois felt about it. So now we get to Judge Daigle. And Your Honor, what we have before us is a notice of appeal that only allows us today to be dealing with whether or not Judge Daigle acted within his discretion in denying a motion to further extend the period in which the plaintiff could respond to the various motions to dismiss. And Judge Daigle was, the notice of appeal is very clear in designating only one specific order. They are only appealing the order that denied their extension. It specifically uses the word deny. It lists the date of that order.
But isn't it true that even a faulty notice of appeal will still be effective if the intention of the appellant is clear and the notice doesn't mislead or prejudice the appellee? And doesn't the farmer's notice of appeal here show their intent to appeal the dismissal of their case?
It does not, Your Honor. I agree that if the notice is ambiguous, if we can look at that notice and fairly read into it that what they meant to do was to appeal the final judgment or the net result of the case or anything like that, yes, you're exactly right. But in this case, the intent is actually very clear from reading the notice that what the only thing that they designated in the notice, and therefore the only thing that this court can have jurisdiction over, is that they said they're entitled to an extension of time to file their response to the defendant's motion to dismiss.
Well, sure.
It was denied by this court, and that is all that they designated.
I know, but what Judge Daigle did was he denied the farmer's motion for enlargement of time, and he dismisses the suit.
Yes, Your Honor.
So, I mean, the failure to point specifically to the dismissal isn't fatal. You know, that's our Barrow case.
Well, no, Your Honor, if you can infer from reading it, from reading the notice of appeal, that where you're going is that they meant to appeal the final case. That's different. You cannot read that into this appeal,
well,
I submit.
What's the prejudice you've suffered? How were you misled? In the first joint brief that was filed by the defendant, Rule 3C wasn't raised, and the statement notes by the defendants that the court has jurisdiction, quote, over an order on April 9, 2001, denying plaintiff's motion to enlarge and dismissing plaintiff's amended complaint with prejudice pursuant to Federal Rule Civil Procedure 12 for improper venue.
Your Honor, with all due respect, whether anybody is misled does not give this court jurisdiction, because the Torres case was clear that Rule 3C is to be interpreted strictly, and it doesn't allow, even in Torres where it was a harsh result, I would submit that it is not here. Unfortunately, I do need to share time with counsel for the other party.
That we do have jurisdiction, that this notice of appeal can be read broadly enough to confer jurisdiction. In that event, how can you defend the dismissal of the case with prejudice?
Thank you, Your Honor. Very easily. What happened here was the plaintiffs filed their case in September of 2000. 7 months later, they came before the judge after three motions to dismiss had been duly served on them and granted by the court. Now, what happened is the first two, I guess they're arguing, would be the best we could do for them in the record. They're saying they didn't get the first two. They absolutely got the last one, which was filed by my client, the annuity company. because we sent it after their change of address form, and we sent it to their address. They did not show up at court that day. They didn't submit anything. The court granted our motion to dismiss on the same grounds as the previous one. And then the party who second had their motion to dismiss granted refiled his and re-noticed it on behalf of Mr. Levinson in an abundance of caution, because they came to the court and said, we're not sure that they got this, let's do it again. They still failed to show up. They came, though, that day 3 hours later, and Judge Daigle talked with them, and what they said was, Judge, we feel we should have a lawyer appointed for us. And the judge says, well, what's your theory for that? And they said, well, we think we're entitled to it under this contract from 1985. He said, what have you done to get that done? Well, in 7 months, nothing. Nothing since this complaint has been filed. And the judge said, you know, I hear your argument there, but I'm not going to delay this in the amount of time it would take you, given that you haven't been diligent to date. And they told the judge they had some particular filings, they had some particular papers that they could get to the court.
Because you're running out of time here, I had asked Mr. Palmer about the dismissal as a sanction. And do you think the record's strong enough to support the dismissal with prejudice as a sanction?
No, Your Honor, we don't get to that order. My co-counsel...
I'll give him some additional time.
We'll argue that. You don't get to that order because the only thing that we're talking about is a discretionary standard on whether or not Judge Daigle was correct in, or whether it is, the point is, whether it is apparent that he abused his discretion in denying the motion to extend. And the reason that I suggest it's not is because all he said was, within 2 weeks, file whatever it is you're telling me about today. File those papers. He understood they weren't going to have a lawyer in 2 weeks. He said, nevertheless, file that. They didn't. They expressly disobeyed his order. Rather, they again suggested to him, you should give us 60 days to try to figure out this lawyer issue. They directly disobeyed his order. And further, he said, I'm going to call Mr. Rouse, who you tell me you have talked to, and I'm going to check out your story. I think it can be reasonably inferred by this court that Judge Daigle would have done that, and that would have gone into his decision in doing what he did. He denied the motion for another extension. He knew that venue was not proper here. Venue was proper in Georgia, where these cases had previously been pursued, and that's where it should have gone. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Fowler, you'll have your full 5 minutes.
Thank you very much. May it please the court, my name is Phil Fowler, and I represent Lewis Levinson. I'd like to begin by answering Judge Evans' question about the sanction issue, and at the same time, I think in that answer, answering Judge Rovner's question about what is it that's in the record that's important and is in front of us that we really need to know about. And what we need to know is that my client was the public guardian of Fulton County. We don't know he's the public guardian by the complaint, but we know he's the guardian. We know a judgment was entered against the mother of Sonika Farmer for $130,000, and that at that point in time, my client then stepped in and became the guardian of the property at the direction of the court. And there's a whole litany of events that take place that are hard to read, and it's not very clear in the complaint, but you can kind of piece them together. Then there's an 8-year wrestling that's going on between the guardian of the property, my client, and the guardian of the person, the mother of the child, over whether they should have a house, whether it should be taken away from them, whether or not she should be getting money to pay the medical bills, whether the medical bill should be paid directly, whether the medical trust should be shut down because the trustee was improperly giving money to the mother that wasn't going to the doctors for the care of the child, whether or not, and this was litigated, and it was litigated in a number of courts. The probate court is all laid out in the complaint. It said my client filed charges with DCFS, and there was proceedings in the juvenile court as to whether or not the mother was fit. All of this went on, and it's important because it went on in Georgia. or North Carolina.
So then why wouldn't the neatest and best way to deal with this, you know, terribly messy, difficult case be to remand with directions to the district court to transfer the case and end it all wherever it needs to be ended?
This is where I answered Judge Evans' question, because the interplay between the transfer statute and Rule 41 and this court's opinion, what this court said in the Cote case about abuse of process. And when you purposely or knowingly or obviously file in the wrong venue, put all the resources of the defendants to come up to the wrong place to defend the case, all the resources and expenses of the court, knowing you don't belong there in the first instance. And there is no way anybody could read this complaint, particularly these people, knowing what they went through over the 7 years of litigation, contempt proceedings, jailing.
Oh, the defendants moved to change venue.
Pardon me?
The defendants moved to change the venue?
I mean, no.
Ordinarily what you do, if there's a case filed and you think it's abusive, it's a repetitive litigation that happened,
we filed a motion to
come in and say, send this case to Georgia.
Well, we moved to dismiss it. And when that happened, nobody showed up. Clearly they got two of the orders. I refiled mine because it was I got a late notice of a change of address. I wasn't sure they got it. Wanted to know if pro se plaintiff came in and refiled the thing. They told the court they didn't get any of them. They told Judge Zagel that they filed this case because they thought the statute of limitations was running. They told Judge Zagel that they wanted the military to come in, and he asked them, did you talk to the military? Yes. When did you do it? Before we filed the lawsuit. And in that colloquy, he said, Mr. Abrams, the father, the person who purported to be the father and a spokesman for the mother and the child, said, and we were told by the lawyers it probably doesn't belong here. So in other words, they knowingly, willfully filed this case to park it until they could work out getting counsel and work out getting where it goes. And when that happens, this court says absolutely you should not transfer it. You should not transfer it. That's the Cote case, and there's a subsequent case by this circuit that affirmed that principle in Happenhousky. There's another case that we cited in our brief, PPL, and I agree with counsel, there is not a lot of authority on this, which is a district court case, a bankruptcy court case out of the D.C. Circuit, that followed Cote and dismissed with prejudice as a sanction for filing in the wrong venue, knowingly filing on the wrong venue, doing it for improper purposes, doing it because you didn't think you could meet the statute of limitations. Mm-hmm. And it violates all the principles behind the venue and behind our statute of limitations policies. And for that reason, we think the trial court should be affirmed.
Is Seneca still a ward? Forgive me. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, that's okay.
Is Seneca still a ward?
The complaint says that they filed it on the anniversary of her 20th birthday, thinking that they had 2 years after she turned 18 to file. It's my understanding from speaking to my client that in Georgia, she would only be a ward up to her 18th birthday. My client was never involved in any of this litigation in the probate court in Chicago, but it's my understanding, and this is hearsay, Judge, that he heard from talking to other persons, that they dismissed the guardianship up here but entered an order extending the length of the guardianship in Georgia until the child was 21. I don't know whether that's true. I haven't seen the court records on that. That's the only information I have on it. I knew more. I don't.
Thank you, Mr. Fallon.
Thank you.
Ms. Palmer? I'll give you an additional 5 minutes since we've allowed counsel.
Maybe I should go back and hit my notes up in here. That long litany of the history of this case that I gave this court to begin with was not just to waste my 7 minutes during my main time. It was to point out to the court also that this court was not misled by that notice of appeal that was filed. No one was misled. Everyone knew that they were appealing the dismissal, and that's why this court appointed counsel to deal with that specific issue. And I believe it's the Bradley case that was authored by Judge Wood in this court that looked at Appellate Rule 3, and Appellate Rule 3 says you have to specify in your notice of appeal what court you're appealing to, and the notice of appeal issue in that case didn't. And Judge Wood, for the court, wrote, "We overlook those technicalities when no one is misled." So the concept of being misled is important when you're looking at that notice of appeal. With respect to the sanctions issue, again, the court didn't dismiss the case as a sanction. The court very specifically ruled that it was dismissing with prejudice for improper venue.
Do we know if the court considered transferring the case before dismissing?
There is nothing in the record that indicates anyone requested that or that the court gave it any consideration at all. Mr. Fowler mentioned that that his client did not participate in the probate proceedings in Illinois. All I can tell from the record, from what Mr. Abrams told Judge Sagel, was that Mr. Levinson did participate. He appeared in that court. He defended him. There was a defense of him in that court. And that's what was before Judge Sagel at the time. So there is really an issue of whether or not venue is proper in this district. And that issue should be decided after it's fully briefed, after they're given an enlargement of time within which to respond to the motion to dismiss. However, I acknowledge that's an abuse of discretion standard that's very difficult to establish. But I think with respect to the dismissal with prejudice, that is not an abuse of discretion. That's a matter of law. Court cannot dismiss with prejudice for an improper venue. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank
you very much. Thank you, Mr. Palmer, also for taking on the assignment.